then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 22nd, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and I'm going to bray at you some on this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This has been a rough week, so to start off with, I want to apologize for patchy communications. My computer had to go in for major surgery, and I just got it back, so things have gotten backed up. This episode isn't actually late, by the way, since the official post deadline is 8 p.m. Pacific time every Thursday. It's true that I've been able to get the program on the air a day or so earlier for the past few weeks, but one of the reasons I moved the deadline to Thursday nights was because sometimes we have things going on during the weekends that carry over into the beginning of the week, and I get behind on doing a podcast. That's not the only reason I'm behind this week, though. I have to admit, I've been having trouble with this one. It's because there are some things I need to be saying here that, for various reasons having to do with diplomacy and the taking the long view of things, I probably shouldn't be saying in public. Yes, believe it or not, there are some things that even I realize I shouldn't say in public. It's about certain of our so-called comrades, or at least fellow travelers, in the racial struggle and some of the things they've been doing. And before we go any further, no, I'm not talking about Jim Giles. I heard what he said, and it doesn't bother me. That's just Jim. Jim Giles is that rarity, a true Nietzschean man in that he has overthrown the tyranny of intellect. Each one of his podcasts is a work of art. That may not be what he intends, but they are, and I listen to them with genuine pleasure. If Jim was doing a one-man show on Broadway, you'd have to pay $200 for front-row tickets. No, I'm talking about some Tea Party types whose limp-wristed kosher conservative cowardice and snobbery regarding other white people may be about to cost a man his life. I don't know that for sure, but it's possible, and since there is a human life in the balance, I will say nothing here about what's been going on. But it pisses me off to the point where I've had to redo the vocal on this episode a couple of times, so if it sounds a bit rough and choppy at times, that's why. Now for our weekly Edgar Steele update. Apparently, Scotty has beamed Mr. Steele back down from the Enterprise because he's back in the Spokane County Jail, and the official government version of events is that he never left. I guess we just imagined all those returned letters, including my own, all the visitors who were turned away, all the phone calls wherein the deputies and jailers denied that he was in their facility. And I guess we just made up the deputy who told numerous callers that Steele had been removed from the jail by the U.S. Marshals. The Marshals refused to comment, apparently, even to reporters. And then there was the long silence, the lack of any phone calls, except for the two which were apparently arranged by the government to entrap and incriminate Steele. Anyway, all of that is now inoperative, as they used to say back in Watergate days. Apparently, Steele was allowed to receive one visitor this week, although we don't know who, and we don't know what was discussed. So whatever the feds were planning, evidently they thought the better of it, at least as far as making him disappear goes. I can't help but wonder if even that one visit would have been allowed if there hadn't been so much of an outcry on the internet and there hadn't been so many people calling the jail and sending letters and generally making sure the regime knew that Ed has friends on the outside who are paying attention. This is why writing letters to prisoners is so important. The worst thing that can happen to any prisoner is for the government to get the idea that all his people on the outside have cut him loose loose and that they can do whatever the hell they want to him or her on the inside because nobody remembers they exist and nobody cares. I've been informed that the government has set a trial date for Steele sometime in August, which is lightning speed by federal standards. Remember, this is the same system where Bill White, for example, had to wait almost 18 months for a trial. Looks like they're going to try to ram this one through quick. Steele has been allocated a public defender. Although he's quite affluent, the government has seized and frozen his life savings and all his assets, which is another odd aspect to this case. My understanding is that asset forfeiture usually applies only in drug or organized crime cases, and then only after conviction. But let's face it, this is the Obama regime, and they're just going to do whatever the hell they want to Edgar Steele without any regard for little niceties like the law or the Constitution or basic human decency. I mean, it's not as if anybody's going to do anything about it, right? The practical effect of the government's seizing all Steele's money is to make sure that Steele has no choice but to rely on a public defender, who is, of course, paid by the very same regime that's prosecuting Ed Steele and doing their damnedest to try and make sure he dies in prison. What is wrong with this picture? Something's definitely going on here, and if nothing else, the incredible lengths to which the government is going just to muddy the waters tends to convince me more and more of his innocence. If this was just a normal common or garden variety conspiracy case, and if Edgar Steele really did try to hire a hitman to kill his wife and mother-in-law, and if they've got it all on tape, then what's the government worried about? They're sure not acting like this case is a slam dunk, and that puzzles me. Another website recently published a brief letter from Edgar Steele to a friend of his on the outside, which I won't read out loud here because it sounds pretty dispirited. Ed is obviously suffering from severe depression, as indeed he might, in view of the fact that, given his age and his severe health problems, he is now going to die in prison for the crime of defending Richard Butler against Morris Dees and that wealthy real estate developer, what's his name, who owns most of North Idaho now. Apparently, in North Idaho, lowering property values now carries the death sentence. The Northwest Front now has our own Edgar Steele site at edgarsteele.blogspot.com. That's Edgar Steele, one word, .blogspot.com. And on that site, you can find Edgar Steele's address in the Spokane County Jail. Folks, seriously, you need to write to this man, if only just a postcard, to let him know that he has not been forgotten. Now, despite Steele's miraculous reappearance in the Spokane Jail, we still don't know if all of his mail is getting through, or even any of it is. But you need to try. Drop Ed Steele a card or a letter today. I repeat, his address is located at edgarsteele.blogspot.com, or you can email me at nwnet@earthlink.net and I'll direct you there. Okay, next up, it's Grandpa Simpson time, wherein Harold goes off on a long, pointless story about things that happened back in the misty dawn of time. Who knows, if I get much more senile, we may have a regular feature like this every week. Karina from Oregon wants to know about the time I was sued by Fred Rogers, which I referred to in last week's podcast. For the record, no, I wasn't actually sued as such. I just got some nasty letters from his attorneys. This had to do with a white power hotline recording I made for the Klan. And yes, like just about every other long-term white national, especially in the South, I spent a brief period with the Klan. This was exactly 20 years ago, in 1990, when this happened. Many of our younger listeners may not remember recorded white power messages, but I'm sure most of the older people will. These were 2 to 3 minute phone recordings, kind of like voicemail. Only back in the old pre-digital and pre-Skype days, you actually had to have a physical message unit and a separate telephone line installed in somebody's house or in your office if you were lucky enough to have one. Once you got your message unit in, you printed up cards and stickers and had your people pass them out, and of course, once the word got out in the community, your phone line was always jammed. I've often wondered if that might not be a tactic worth trying again, and we may give it a shot someday if we can ever raise the scratch for a separate phone line and unit. People remember those messages, especially kids who call it up when they get home from school for fun. My first white power message in Raleigh lasted about 5 years, and for years afterwards, I would introduce myself or give my name in a dry cleaners or something like that, and some young person would say, 828-4903. They remembered those phone recordings. Rented voicemail is no good. The last one of those phone messages I ever did was in the late 1990s in Fort Worth when we were using rented voicemail, and we kept burning out and jamming up their switchboard because they got so many calls. What happens is that niggers discover the message and they'll jam the switchboard, and then people will start playing pranks with it. Beeping each other with the message number, beeping their favorite niggers, their boss, trying to get them to call the hotline, etc., etc. Eventually, the overload gets so bad that it takes down the whole system, and the voicemail company cancels your contract for that reason alone, never mind what happens when they call the number and they actually hear what you're saying. That's another reason movement people need to always make sure that our own hands are always on the plug of everything we do. If you've got some kind of project or asset or necessary service or piece of equipment and you don't own it and somebody else's hand is on the plug, then eventually they'll be pressurized by the kikes into pulling that plug on you. And I'm rambling again, sorry. Okay, back to 1990. What happened was I was doing the White Power Hotline messages for our Klan unit in North Carolina, and I came up with a couple of short Mr. Rogers parodies that I put on the hotline for a couple of succeeding weeks. I can't remember the exact scripts, but I do remember one was about drugs and one was about AIDS. The first one went something like, "Today, boys and girls, we're going to meet a new person in our neighborhood. He's right there, standing on the corner. This is Tyrone. Tyrone is an African-American pharmaceuticals entrepreneur. Can you say nigger dope dealer? Sure you can." And then it goes on about how the Klan shows up and lynches Tyrone on the streetlight, and it ended something like, "Now Tyrone is really hanging out on the corner." And the one about AIDS went something like, "Today, boys and girls, we're going to meet Charlie and Martin." Charlie and Martin were two well-known local faggots in our area, and Charlie really did die of AIDS eventually. Anyway, the message went on, "Charlie and Martin are involved in a committed gay alternative lifestyle. Can you say loathsome perversion? Sure you can. Today, we're going to visit Charlie and Martin in the AIDS hospice. We're going to watch them rot. Won't that be fun, boys and girls?" Okay, these messages were quite popular, as you can imagine, and all of the other units in our Klan group wanted copies of the cassette tapes for their own answering machine units. And they contacted me, and I said fine, so I did some more tapes and mailed them around the country. The one that caught official attention was the phone message in Kansas City, Missouri, run by Dennis Mahon. And that's another name all you young movement whippersnappers out there ought to know, but nobody does. In June of last year, the BATFE did an Edgar Steele on Dennis Mahon and his brother Dan, arrested them in a midnight raid, and buried them alive somewhere. And so far as I know, no one's ever heard from them again, or at least nobody's bothered to cover it on the internet. If they have come to trial and somebody knows what happened, please let me know, because nothing shows on Google about it that I can find. A note, this is the same system that's rushing Edgar Steele to trial after 2 months. Both Mahon brothers are in their 60s. I guess federal law enforcement really gets off on arresting old men and making them die in prison. I think they're trying to send us a message that the Jews never forgive and never forget. Well, we knew that. Anyway, the local paper in Kansas City heard the Mr. Rogers parody hotline on the local Klan unit's message unit, and they ran an editorial about how dare us wicked racists make a mockery of kind, wonderful Mr. Rogers. And the story went out on the wire services. Rogers himself heard about it, and his lawyer started raising Cain with Dennis and threatening to sue him. Now, Dennis denied that he'd done the recording, and then he called me, and I said, fine, give him my name. It's my work, and I won't deny it. Rogers is a public figure, and I have every right to parody him just as much as Eddie Murphy does on Saturday Night Live, and that's what I told the lawyers during the subsequent exchange of nasty letters, and that was pretty much it. They saw that I wasn't going to back down, and I don't think they wanted my parody tapes played in court, because then everybody would remember Mr. Rogers talking about nigger dope dealers hanging on the corner and faggots rotting away from AIDS like Monsieur Valdemar. My guess is that Rogers decided, or was persuaded, not to give us any more publicity, so it just died out. I did get one call from a nigger reporter for the Kansas City paper, named Pettibone, believe it or not. He tried to interview me on the phone, and I started doing my Mr. Rogers voice. "This is Mr. Pettibone, boys and girls. Mr. Pettibone is a Negro journalist. Can you say unethical reptile? Sure you can." And as I kept going back and forth like this, he got more and more pissed off and finally says, "Hey, knock off the Mr. Rogers impersonation." And I replied, "Why, what do you mean, Negro journalist? I talk like this all the time." And he says, "Yeah, well, I talk like this all the time, motherfucker." And then he slams down the phone. I don't know if he ever printed anything out of that interview. You know, that's one thing I do remember about back in the day. We laughed a lot. That's something you can't say these days. There's something about the internet that has brought out something really mean and vicious and very nasty in our people, really sick-making, bad craziness. It started with Usenet. It's like watching a werewolf movie where a guy's sitting at a keyboard and he transforms into some kind of lower life form with all kinds of icky, sticky goo oozing out of his soul. Or maybe it's just that American society has gotten so much more mean and vicious and hateful in the past 20 years. I don't know. I do know that by and large, the laughter is gone. Now how's that for a Grandpa Simpson rave? That kind of leads me on into the next subject, which is an unpleasant one I've had to deal with before. Once again, I can hear the pleas of, "No, Harold, do not speak of such things. The problem isn't that these things are happening. The problem is that you are talking about them." Yes, it's our old friend, the character issue, and we all know that if Harold will just shut up and stop talking about it, it will all just go away, like it has for the past 50 years of failure. I got an email from a young lady in California named Gina. I won't read it out because it names names, and apparently that's the line I'm not allowed to cross, but basically, we seem to be going through one of our periodic episodes of space madness in the movement, and there's a lot of internet bad-mouthing of me personally in the Northwest Imperative going on in certain places. It's kind of like sunspots or solar flares. We have these dormant periods when everything is fairly quiet, and then all of a sudden, a kind of epidemic of St. Vitus's dance seems to run all through the internet boards and groups accusing me of all kinds of things, from square dancing in a roundhouse to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. However, I will say this, the goat dancing is getting a little bit more political and ideological in nature, which I think is a good sign. At least the Fruit Loops are attacking my ideas now. I understand, for example, that right now on Stormfront there's some big long thread going on from some verbose, pompous ass about why the Northwest Imperative absolutely cannot and will not work, and you mustn't listen to that wicked man Harold Covington. He will lead you astray, yada yada yada. I haven't even bothered to read it. The first thing you need to understand, Gina, is that right now, white nationalism in this country is about 95% internet. We have virtually no presence anywhere in the real world. Some of us, such as myself, are desperately working to change that. And someday it will change when things get so bad that white kids can no longer hide in their basement rec rooms and spend all day playing online games because the power's out and the internet is down. But for the moment, the fact of life is that we are almost all internet, which in one way is a good thing because that means that almost none of this is real. And when the shit hits the fan and we're forced back into the real world, it will all pretty much vanish in a puff of smoke. There's very little of this goat dancing nonsense that can't be undone and forgotten about very quickly when things do get real. Unfortunately, as more and more people read my Northwest novels, listen to me on Radio Free Northwest, and become aware of the Northwest Imperative, we're going to get more and more of this kind of weird internet behavior, these apparently unmotivated attacks right out of the blue from people who claim to believe more or less as we do, and who claim to be serving the 14 words. The late Pastor Bob Miles once said to me, "You know, Harold, there's been so much bullshit in the movement for so long that when the real thing finally does come along, these people won't recognize it, and when they do recognize it, they'll try to tear it down." Well, the real thing has finally come along now, the Northwest Imperative, and it looks like Bob was spot on. You see, Gina, it's a sad but human fact that the white nationalist movement, like every other human institution, actually has something of an establishment, a small clique at the top, mostly internet bulletin board masters who have been able to attract a large number of readers to their boards. I once referred to our movement establishment as the Knights Who Say Nick, but that didn't catch on, and so I suppose we might call them the Lords of V-Bulletin. These long-standing V-Bulletin boards are controlled by little cliques of mostly dysfunctional moderators who have their own little fantasy empires online and show their faux power by banning and targeting people that they don't like, that kind of silliness. These boards and websites form a kind of status quo, and as always, when that happens, there's a small group of people at the top of the shit heap who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo and who don't appreciate people like us Northwesters rocking the boat. In the last civil letter that the late William Pierce ever wrote to me, he told me, "The problem is, Harold, that we're all chasing the same buck." Now that's true, and I think some of the flack we're catching from the Lords of V-Bulletin is because they fear that the NF will become financial competition for the donation dollar. And they're right. Eventually, as we become more widely known and more people grasp the Northwest vision, and above all, when you guys finally pack the moving vans and we can start showing some real boots on the ground as opposed to silly emails posted in cyberspace under aliases, the NF will start sucking away some of what little money there still is within the movement away from the V-Bulletin boards. But I think it's more than that, a lot more. Let me choose my words here carefully. Another thing you have to understand, Gina, is that the white nationalist movement is full of people who join us for the wrong reasons, reasons having to do with their own mental and emotional problems, and not from any desire actually to help the white race or to serve the 14 words. The way I put this is that entirely too many people become involved with various kinds of white nationalism, not because they want to put something into it, but because they want to get something out of it. A very high percentage of our self-appointed leaders, even on the internet where the money factor doesn't really apply, are motivated by their ego. In fact, I think ego is actually a much more important factor in these internet times than mere money. The internet feeds the ego like a crack cocaine or heroin addiction, to where some of these people, I think, lose track of who they are in the real world, and they become their internet personalities. In their internet fantasy world, they can do or say anything they want, without consequences and without repercussions. If I had to put my finger on it, I would say that's probably the ultimate appeal, the ultimate lure and addiction of the internet. It offers spoiled, corrupt, morally weak and lazy white people the gift of consequences-free misbehavior. Consequences-free misbehavior leads to a feeling of almost godlike omnipotence. A lord of the internet feels he can say or do anything he wants to do, secure in the cool, dark den or rec room where he hides behind his computer. Look at the example of Bill White. It's a hell of an ego trip, and the Northwest Imperative and the Northwest Front threaten that ego trip precisely because I will talk about these things in public. Exactly because I do demand that you all replace words with deeds, beginning with the simple act of packing that moving van and coming home. The Northwest Imperative is unique within the white nationalist movement because, unlike anything else, it is deed-based as opposed to word-based. Every other movement, group, or tendency is defined by its leaders and supporters through something that they say, usually posed to the internet. The Northwest Migration is defined by something you do. This has never been seen in the movement since the days of George Lincoln Rockwell, when the defining act was to stand up and wear the swastika in public. The lords of V-Bulletin instinctively get all this. They recognize instinctively that the Northwest Imperative is a serious threat to the status quo, and that I'm a threat to their egos, and they respond by poo-pooing the Northwest and attacking me personally. We're just going to have to add the goat dance to the list of things that I have to periodically go over again many times on these broadcasts, because this problem of our so-called racial comrades dragging their feet, kicking and screaming and holding their breath until their faces turn blue, and doing everything they can to try and hold us back is going to be with us for a long time. I'm sorry, Gina, things shouldn't be this way. We shouldn't be this way, but we have to play the hand we're dealt, and this Attack the Northwest on the Internet silliness is part of it. Get used to it and learn to just take it all in stride as part of the wonderful warp and weave of movement life. I do. This is Night Noise. Okay, this is the point where I first tried to do something on here and then decided not to do it. I was going to cut this whole section out, but then I decided to leave in the part I did get done, because there are some ideas in here you need to consider. As you know, I've been asking for some weeks now for other people to contribute to this show, because I genuinely don't cotton to the idea of being a one-man band. Others need to see and hear that there's more than one person involved in the Northwest Migration Movement. I especially encourage our female comrades to contribute. I've asked for 5 to 7 minute MP3 files that I can just drop into the show here. I can, if necessary, rip an MP3 file from a CD. That's what I had to do with Gorilla Man last week. I also stated, possibly prematurely, that if you don't have the technical expertise or the equipment to do an MP3, you can type something out and email it to me and I'll read it on the air. That may have been a mistake, because I can foresee a situation arising where I end up doing almost nothing during the full hour other than reading other people's articles. Now, people really need to hear sound on this show. That's why it's called radio. And by that, I mean a sound other than my hoarse and droning, babbling voice. That's one of the two reasons for the music breaks. If you'll forgive me another Grandpa Simpson digression, I remember back in the day when the John Birch Society or some other right-wing group would hold a meeting in some church basement or somebody's living room, and after the tea and cookies, someone would bring out a boombox and insert the latest cassette tape from National Headquarters, and all the little old ladies of both genders would sit there and go, ooh, and ah, as Fearless Leader droned on and on and on for hours on end like Fidel Castro about the Illuminati and the Federal Reserve and the Bilderbergers, yada, yada, yada. Sometimes there was more than one cassette. Now, that technique of audio communication isn't necessarily bad. It's definitely an improvement over long blocks of printed type that most white people below the age of 40 can't read or understand anymore. I've used cassettes myself as recently as a few years ago until I came to realize that nobody owns cassette players anymore except old dinosaurs like me. After all, the Iranian Revolution was brought about by Khomeini sending instructions from exile to his followers in Iran via cassette tape. But some of those right-wing cassettes we used to mail each other back in the old days were just plain bad. Long and boring, and the Fearless Leader sounded like Mortimer Snerd, and, I'm doing it again, aren't I? Sorry, where was I? What I'm saying is that I far prefer you folks to do your own audio files and send them to me by email attachment. Not only because it sounds better, but because all of you need to get used to using audio as a propaganda tool, and you need to master the technology and technique involved. However, I did say that I myself would read aloud some of the better efforts. Accordingly, I was going to read you guys a movie review written by one of our comrades, which I received by email. And in an earlier version of this podcast, I actually tried to do so, and, well, let's put it this way, it was a disaster. There's no question that if I'd included that segment, I would have lost most of my audience, and most of you would have said, Harold, why the hell are you wasting our time with this drivel? Now, this is not to say that it was a bad movie review. It wasn't. But there are times when print simply does not translate into vocal dialogue without sounding really stiff and stilted and completely boring the audience to death. Now, Steve, I'm sorry, it just didn't work. You wrote an excellent and erudite review, which was meant to be read, not read out loud. The combination of your prose and my voice is not a fortuitous one. Guys, you're going to have to do like I've done over the past year. As old a dog as you may be, you're going to have to force yourself kicking and screaming to learn new tricks. You're going to have to learn this technology. I have never denied that as poisonous as it has been for us in so many ways, the internet does have its uses. And the way things are going now, slowly but surely, the internet is in fact undermining the mainstream media. We need to get in on that. The problem with white racial internet radio is the same problem we always have, preaching only to the choir. Inability to break out of the bubble and get somebody besides our same old faces listening to us every week, if you'll pardon my mixed metaphors. There is, I estimate, a hardcore of white nationalist internet radio audience numbering maybe as high as 20,000 people. That is, of course, only a tiny fraction of the white American population as a whole, although, of course, 20,000 people is all we need to establish our Northwest Republic if we could ever get their pale asses up here to the homeland and somehow convert them all into class alphas. We actually have some pretty good racial video and audio floating around out there, but the problem is that so few white people even know that it exists, never mind listening and paying attention to it. There's so much rubbish on YouTube about beer-drinking cats and celebrity gibberish and whatnot that some very good racial media stuff simply goes unnoticed. It gets lost in the shuffle. I myself had never even heard of Saga until about 9 months ago. The long and the short of it is, guys, I think I kind of have to retract my offer to read out people's essays and articles on here. In the first place, just because someone's a good writer, that doesn't mean they sound good being read aloud. And secondly, we need to hear some other voices on here besides mine. One last thing, it's been suggested that I turn this show into a call-in with guests and interviews like so many internet radio shows are. Now, the problem with that is I would have to use Skype. Now, did I mention that I had to have a complete computer rebuild this weekend and that our Computermeister found almost 100 virus-infected files on this machine, almost all of which came in through Skype? I think I'm going to be looking for some other means of voice communication, thank you. Okay, let's wander back in a general northwesterly direction here. This is from Dave in the UK. Dear HAC, what's with this business of legalized dueling in the Northwest Constitution? Well, I'm surprised nobody's picked up on that yet, but I suppose eventually it was inevitable that someone would actually sit down and read the whole document. To encapsulate this as concisely as I can, Dave, one of the many, many problems with liberal democratic society is a proliferation of a seemingly endless number of assholes in all walks of life, but especially in positions of petty power. They're everywhere. In the UK, here, anywhere that the laws of political correctness and so-called democracy control things. It's not so much that the laws of democracy are designed to uphold the rich and oppress the poor of any race, although that's very much the case. Oliver Wendell Holmes said that the law is meant to be a shield, not a sword, and so it has become. The law is a shield for assholes. It allows assholes to germinate and to flourish and to populate and overrun the earth, like when some idiot introduced rabbits into Australia back in the 19th century. They bred into hundreds of millions and destroyed the wilderness and wiped out a lot of native species because rabbits have no natural predators or enemies in Australia. And it's like that. In modern-day America and Britain, assholes no longer have any natural predators to keep down their numbers. The law shields and protects assholes while restraining and punishing their natural predators and enemies. And so assholes have flourished and have reproduced to the point where they're about to destroy the whole environment. Okay, that's an oversimplification, but I think all of you who actually have to live in this world out there get what I'm trying to say here. The problem is that in modern democratic society, there is no penalty attached to being an asshole. There needs to be. There are no consequences for acting like an asshole, and there should be. I would hope that there will be only the minimum policing necessary in the Republic in order to keep the state functioning, and one reason for that would be that our men know how to settle their own problems and don't go running to the cops bawling for protection when they piss somebody off. Sure, in any society, you're going to get bullies and people who abuse others and who abuse some small position of petty power they've achieved. Ordinary people need some way of dealing with that, some way to enforce courtesy, some way to enforce civility, some way to enforce respect. You know the great American movie dilemma of the big muscle man or the gang versus the skinny little guy with a brain and the sense of humor? Well, in the Northwest Republic, he'll have a remedy if he has the courage and the strength of character to use it. Remember, as the historian Thomas Carlyle once wrote, gunpowder makes all men tall. I don't suppose many of you folks have ever heard of a man from the mountains of North Carolina called Doc Watson. If not, it's time you were introduced. This is Lonesome Banjo Blues.
If you can pick a little bit of that lonesome banjo there, son, that Arnold put together. That's a pretty good lonesome tune there.
This is from Ted in Birmingham, Alabama. Dear HAC, thanks for the intro package. I'm leaning towards the Northwest Front, but I have a couple of questions. My first question is about your health and who will take over after you're no longer with us. Hopefully it will not be like at the National Alliance when William Pierce passed on. Internal conflict followed by irrelevance. My second question is about whether the issue of sustainability is being addressed. In case the system collapses, as I think it will, are we moving to places where we can be entirely self-sufficient? I posted this in my latest blog here at New Saxon, which I will paste at the bottom here, and he attaches a blog article. If you're not sure what I'm talking about when I mention system collapse, look on Amazon.com at the book reviews for a book called The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. I hope things get to be wonderful for you, and thanks for your kind attention. Okay, your second question first, Ted. Yes, I'm familiar with the work of James Howard Kunstler, and he's spot on with some of his analysis, so much so that he's the only Jew whom I will allow onto my Thought Crime blog as an occasional unwitting guest columnist. I also read his Clusterfuck Nation blog regularly. I won't read out all of Ted's article from New Saxon, but I don't think I'm being unfair when I summarize it as an argument for enclaves instead of worrying about creating a whole new white nation. Yes, I know I've covered this before several times, but remember what I've said about how we're going to run into the very same questions over and over and over, right up to the moment when we actually create the Republic. And in every case, whoever's asking the question most likely is going to be convinced that he himself just thought it up and he won't have heard the answer, or more likely, it just hasn't registered with him. I know it's tiresome, but we must patiently repeat, repeat, and repeat the answer until it finally sinks in. The basic idea of enclaves is that since there are tens of thousands, and indeed hundreds of thousands, of white nationalists, depending on how broad your definition of white nationalism is, the question is this. What if we could get all of us to move to some little town or medium-sized city like Peoria, Illinois, which was Matt Hale's idea, or some rural county in the Northwest that's very sparsely populated, and then we get everybody registered to vote, and we take over the local government, we get our own sheriff who hires only white deputies, we get our own mayor and county commissioners and our own dog catcher, so forth and so on, thereby creating our own white enclave or reservation, or Bantustan, or whatever you want to call it. One of the primary and most obvious objections to setting up an enclave in some small town is that in a confined area like that, the United States military can surround it and occupy it, which is something these Vermont secessionist and New Hampshire libertarians can't seem to wrap their minds around. In the long run, the problem with enclaves in general is that they are too small to survive on their own. They would be landlocked, and they would necessarily be surrounded by hostile territory. They would be very difficult to keep supplied with the necessities of life, which they'd have to import from somewhere else, since it'd be difficult to imagine some little town in Iowa or Texas or Wisconsin having all the manufacturing plant and infrastructure necessary to make everything the community would need. If you think too small, Ted, what you'd end up with would be a white Gaza. I know I've said in the past that our window of opportunity for the Northwest Republic will be a Soviet-style collapse of the United States government, but we don't know yet for sure how the dissolution of the United States is going to come about. Will it be bit by bit? Will it be one big, huge crash? We don't know. How much military force will the United States still command? Will the United States military mutiny? Or will they just sell their weapons for food and wander away, like a lot of the Soviet military in Eastern Europe did in the 1990s? Will they transfer their allegiance to smaller states and entities that can actually pay them, like the Soviet military did? We just don't know these things yet. If the Zionist regime in Washington, D.C. remains in even partial power, then some small white enclave attempting to secede would be surrounded by a bitterly hostile enemy and would eventually be overrun and destroyed. A new white nation in North America needs to possess certain geographic, demographic, and economic assets in order to be viable. We need a lot of geography. There would have to be a lot of room to grow into, since we'll be taking in the remnants of white populations from the world over. The Northwest is so big that the United States simply can't occupy all of it. They can't put a soldier or a cop behind every Douglas fir. A new white nation will need a coastline with deep water harbors so that all access to the country won't rely on overflying or overland travel through hostile territory. There will have to be some kind of navy and air force to resist blockade. There will have to be mineral resources, sufficient arable land and pasture land to grow our own food, and a sufficient infrastructure in manufacturing, energy, transportation, so forth and so on, that the new nation will have a chance to survive and prosper and take in the millions of white people who will eventually flee to the homeland from the ends of the earth, which are still controlled by the Zionists and the liberals. Now, the Northwest has all these things. No other contiguous part of the continent does. Now, the first part of your question, who succeeds me when I kick the bucket? Succeed to what, Ted? The Northwest imperative is, wait for it, an organism, not an organization. It is an idea. The FBI cannot infiltrate an idea. Yes, I know what happened to Pierce, but this is a different situation. Pierce had land and property and money and the legal corporate entity to leave behind. He was confined by his possessions. I don't have anything. I'm not. I've discussed the present loosey-goosey and officially non-existent state of the Northwest Front in the past several podcasts already, so I won't go over that again. As to the Northwest Volunteers, who will be organized. They don't exist yet and will not exist for some time, so we don't need to mess with that right now. I don't mind you asking, Ted. It's a legitimate question. I understand people are concerned about what might happen, especially in view of that god-awful mess that took place after Pierce died. But it's a different situation. He had something to leave behind, something for someone to succeed to. I don't. All I have is you guys. It was never in the cards that I am going to somehow pull the magic beans out of my pocket and do all this for you. I leave you my books and my other writings and these podcasts. I leave you my ideas and my principles and my life of dedication to the 14 words as an example. What you do with them is up to you. Comrade Silas in North Idaho says he has a friend who wants to publish a book, and can I help him out with some advice on self-publishing? Silas, for in-depth, detailed information, your friend should probably email me private with specific details about the book, but sure, in a general way, I don't mind talking about it. Technically, the term for what I do is print-per-order publishing. Now, this means that when you order a book and you plunk down cash on the barrel head, it is then printed and bound and shipped to you by either the publisher or any other vendor with this capability, be it Amazon, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Libris, whatever. I understand you can also order my books online from Walmart now, of all places. This is both an advantage and a disadvantage. One advantage is that you don't have to have big warehouses so that you can, you know, stash cases after case of, you know, 10,000 books in a print run. But the other side of the coin is that you have to plunk down cash on the barrel head for each copy that is brought into existence. So actually producing my books is kind of like producing medieval manuscripts. Each one's kind of an effort in itself. Now, this technology has done something that 70 years of our own effort never accomplished. It's actually broken the back of a major Jewish monopoly in the arts and entertainment field, specifically book publishing, which after Hollywood was at one time probably the second brightest jewel in the Jews' crown. Print per order has allowed us access to quality book-length publishing services at a price that even our destitute movements people and organizations can afford. The playing field still isn't level, and it never will be, but at least we can get onto the field, which we couldn't before. The Northwest Migration Movement will never be able to match the establishment publishers in the money and time and effort we can invest in promotion and advertisement, nor will we be able to get access to the retail and market sales outlets that the establishment publishers have, but at least alternative literature and ideas can get published now. You have no idea how great an advance that is. It used to be that printing and publishing and distributing a single politically incorrect book was a major lifelong project that sometimes literally killed the author, as witnessed Francis Parker Yockey. The story of all the things that William Gailey Simpson had to go through to find a publisher for Which Way Western Man would fill a book in itself. Now, if we can ever address the character issue and create a bona fide resistance movement, we no longer have that technological and logistic hurdle. The opportunity is there if we ever decide we want to get our act together and use it. Now, can anything be accomplished through fiction? Well, Uncle Tom's Cabin has been credited with starting the Civil War, and the Turner Diaries has been given credit for inspiring the Order as well as other things, so the power of the written word shouldn't be underestimated. Now, granted, the number of white people who are willing to sit down and actually read a block of type for content is a very small proportion of the population, but they are out there. And many of them are willing to at least make the attempt if they know ahead of time the book is something politically incorrect and forbidden. Another great Aryan musical talent, whose name you folks out there need to learn, is the late Stan Rogers, a Canadian folk singer who was killed in a fire on an Air Canada plane in 1983 at the age of 33, but who left behind some of the best music ever made by any man. It makes you thank God he lived in the age of recording so that his music didn't die with him like so many troubadours of our people's past. This is The Witch of the Westmoreland.
Of the Westmoreland can make thee stallion's head, till his red mane fights in the wind, and the rider of the moon goes by, and the bright star falls behind. And clear was the paling moon when the shadow passed him by. Below the hill were the brightest stars, and he heard the owl cry, singing, "Why do you ride this way? The winding near, it's weary by the owl's water and the misty break fern way, till through the cut of the Kirkston pass the winding waterway. Down me brindle town, rest ye me good grey hawk, and me my steed may graze thy field from us dismount and walk. But come when you hear my horn, and answers with the call, for I fear the sun will rise this morn, you'll serve me best of all. And it's down to the water spring he's borne the rowan shield, and the golden rod he has passed in to see what the lake might yield. And when rose she from the lake, and fast and fleet went she, one half the form of a maiden fair with a jet black mare's body. And loud, long, and shrill he blew till his steed was by his side. Certainly he did ride, saying, "Horse, well, me bring it all down. Fetch me the jet black mare, stoop and strike me the gray hawk, and bring me the maiden fair." My silvery sword, lay down thy rowing shield, for I see by the briny blood that flows you've been wounded in the field. And she stood in a gown of the velvet blue, bound round with a silver chain, and she's kissed his bailiffs once and twice, and three times round again. And she's bound his wound with the golden rod, oh, fast in her arms he lay. Hail, and soon at the sun high in the day, she said, "Ride with your brindled hounds and heel, and your good grey hawk in hand. There's none can harm the knight who's lain with the witch of the West Maryland."
I'd like to make a few quick comments on something I've been picking up on recently. Some of us are going through what I call the 18-month syndrome, although I suppose with the internet accelerating everything, it's a bit shorter than that. This is something I've seen time and again in my many years of struggle, and it goes something like this. Some new person comes into the movement, and at first he's on fire with enthusiasm. Yeah, this is it. We're going to go get him now. I'm going to storm the barricades. And then after about 18 months or so, he or she notices that there doesn't seem to have been much actual change or progress since they first came in. For whatever reason, Fearless Leader is not out storming the barricades, and he's not on television every night rapping with Larry King or Sean Hannity or whoever, and the whole thing's just not entertaining anymore. The short American attention span sets in, they all get bored and restless, and they say, nothing's happening, nothing's moving, it's just the same old shit on the internet. Harold's never gonna really do anything. I thought I was getting the NVA, but Harold hasn't assassinated anybody yet, so forth and so on. The individual gets disillusioned and wanders away somewhere else in search of fresh stimulation and entertainment. Look, guys, I get it. I understand that you're all looking to Harold to pull a rabbit out of the hat, and I try. I do what I can with whatever you give me to work with. The last sort of semi-rabbit I was able to pull out of my hat was these podcasts beginning last January, and now the novelty's beginning to wear off these. Now, I know that you don't figure anybody or anything is actually real unless he's on TV. We've been raised from birth to believe that we have to be validated in some way by our masters, by the system, and that unless we can get that validation, we don't really exist. And that goes for the Northwest Front as well as anyone else. If the system doesn't acknowledge our existence, that means we're not really here, right? I keep telling you that's the one thing about armed struggle. If we can ever somehow find the courage to do it, they can't pretend it's not happening. Holes in the ground where federal buildings used to be are impossible even for this media to ignore. Holes in the heads of wealthy and powerful individuals can't be wished away into non-existence simply by not reporting them on CNN. Now, there's another novelty I'm going to try in a bit, one that might even generate some publicity for us. There was some medical stuff I had to get out of the way, and finally I got that done yesterday, and now there's a legal thing I need to take care of. But once that's done, I'll reach down in that hat and see if I can't come up with something furry. If not a rabbit, then, well, maybe a muskrat or a dead cat or something. I won't get into that now. I'll let you know later when it's time. Now, some people ask me, Harold, what do you need to get the job done? Very simple. The three C's. I need cash, carcasses, and courage. I need massive amounts of money. Anybody who tells you it's possible to bring about serious change of any kind without money in a society where money is power is lying to you. 2 years ago, it cost $500 million to put a jigaboo in the White House. We can bring our new nation to birth with a lot less than that, but we can't do it with nothing but two dimes to rub together in our pocket. I need carcasses, specifically your carcass. I need all of you, here in the homeland, not sitting behind your computers in Texas or New York or Florida or Pittsburgh. I need you here, settled, employed, functional in society, and ready to devote the rest of your lives to the Northwest American Republic. Finally, I need you and all of our people to change their thinking and recover their ancient courage, so that when the time comes to act, you will be outdoors and standing erect, and not hiding in your closets along with your Confederate reenactors gear and all those guns that you keep so clean and never intend to use. Those are the three things I need, guys, and all three of those are your department, not mine. You want the world I portray in my Northwest novels? Fine, you can have it. It's here, waiting for you, but you're going to have to make it yourselves. No one is going to give it to you ready-made. You don't get off the hook. Now, you say Harold is never going to do anything? Well, you're right, I won't. Not on my own, sitting here behind a computer. I need all of you to get your asses up here, get with the program, and quit trying to dodge all the heavy lifting that has to be done. Then 30 years from now, when you're old men sitting around in your dens having a few beers and talking over old times with other veterans of the Northwest War of Independence, you'll say among yourselves, you know, I was always amazed at how easy it all turned out to be once we finally quit screwing around and just went ahead and did it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenban. Freedom.